You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, this is Jen Graves, and you're listening to Invisible, The Stranger's weekly conversation with people in art. Hi.
Hi.
I'm here with Sergio Vega. We are at Open Satellite in Bellevue, the morning after the opening of Tropical Rush. And that's your exhibition of some new work and some older work. There is a video, there are several photographs, there are several text pieces, and there's a very large screen. What is that made of?
It's made out of felt. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of synthetic felt that is actually used for car carpets.
It looks kind of fuzzy.
Yes.
And it has the very large screen is black, and it is kind of cut in the shape of, as though it were a jungle. Mm-hmm. And it's really facing off with the windows, very
That's
much
correct.
So, sort
That's
of,
correct.
You know, blocking them in this very, very bold way. You have several different kinds of works here, but all of these are a continuation on kind of your lifelong work. Mm-hmm. How did you first get started? Did you first start working on Paradise in the New World when you discovered Pinello? And who was he, and did you find him?
That's right. Okay. What happens is that I was already working with all of these ideas about the exotic and the notions of the representation of the other and cultural stereotypes and the kind of like peculiar idea that exists in the United States about Latin America. I was struck to hear when I moved into this country that in Congress people will talk about not allowing this or that to happen in our backyard, and they were referring to this complex conglomerate of countries and things, and the notion that it was a backyard for the United States, it had also these implications of nature, and you know, and, you own it, but the backyard, you don't control it as much. There may be some raccoons going wild in there, or you may have some wheat growing that you don't want, right? So all the ideological implications of being perceived as a backyard always struck to me, along with all the other stereotypes from, like, you know, trying to sell you like a kitchen package and putting a parrot into the into the image, all those things. But then at one point I found this book just by chance. It was in the lower shelves of a political science library, pretty dusty, and really it looked like trash. I mean, it was two big volumes, and I said, what is this? And then I looked, no one had checked it out since the 70s, and it was one of those books that have the folded pages that you have to cut to open, so I felt pretty much the first like 10 pages were cut, and no one had really read it before, you know. So I cut the pages and I read it, and I became fascinated. And in this book, this is a book that was written in 1650 by a man named Antonio Leon Pinello, who was a very important personality in the whole development of the New World, at least in the Spanish colonies. And he was a very, very highly educated person. He had a degree in law, and he was the first ones who wrote the Indian laws to try to regulate and to end the slavery of the natives in Peru particularly. But he held several political important positions in the Americas, and he was a counselor of the Crown of Spain. And he wrote this theory that the Garden of Eden was located in South America, and I thought that was really hilarious.
Is it essentially a travelogue?
No, the book is not a travelogue, it's a theory, and it has all these...
It's a what?
It's a theory.
Ah, yeah.
It's a theory, and it has a map, and it had all these speculations about why Paradise was there. What the book reflects is a typical ideological contradictions of the 17th century, which on one hand is supporting a theological myth and is trying to find a scientific explanation for it, which for me hilariously you know, we find ourselves in a similar situation now in the United States, you know, trying to, you know, explain one through the other when they really respond. There are very different discourses, but that was the time when natural science was beginning. So it was, he was an intellectual of the time, so he needed to justify this theological myth through the implications of science. So he did an enormous work in the survey of the geography of the whole of the Americas, the indigenous cultures, the flora, the fauna, and all kinds of considerations that were pertinent to the time, to the point that his book, Self for Research for Naturalists Traveling Through Latin America, even to the 19th century. Mm-hmm. So he really, I mean, he didn't serve the purpose to justify that paradise was there, but it served other purposes, the book.
Mm-hmm. And in this exhibition, we're looking at several different series, but one of them that strikes me is five images, large photographs of the rainforest burning.
Yes.
And when I arrived here this morning, you said you were listening to the news, and it's possible that your own house right now is in some danger of burning. You live where?
I live in Florida. Okay. I live in north central Florida.
I hope it's not.
I hope it's not either.
Your house burns while you are podcasting.
That's right.
But those images came from where? You were there last year?
Yes.
And where were you?
This was in the north part of the state of Mato Grosso, which is, you know, where in North Mato Grosso is where this paradise was supposed to be, at least in my specific interpretation of it. And this is the Amazonian region of Mato Grosso, and in an area that is called Novo Mundo, which is New World, and ironically the text was called Paradise in the New World, so it was like a very strange phenomenon to go to New World and find it on fire. And right, but these photographs interest me because I took other ones of flames and that, and those really didn't do anything for me. But these ones interest me because they have some kind of like a romanticist aesthetic, similar to that of like paintings.
Yeah. Hudson River,
yes, like Turner type of light spaces.
Yeah, Turner light. They're very big.
So they, it has that type of like aesthetic, but then instead of, you know, as we know, the theory of the sublime was very important for romanticism, and to see the forces of nature unleashing, you know, beyond human control and in a larger scale was a fascination of that period. But in this case, it's a kind of like perverse pleasure, the one that these photographs elicit, because there are these beautiful, colorful clouds, but then there are smoke and the forest burning.
And there's tiny little areas of fire, little embers.
There were, and it was like the sound of the forest burning is really strong, really strong. I was being eaten alive by bugs when I took that.
That's another thing. You know, there are these wall texts, and they describe. They come from different voices. They don't all come from a unified voice. But what I find really interesting is each one is grounded in a body. Like this one that you're talking about now, the bugs are eating you alive. In another one, there's a dog bite. So where do those different voices come from?
Well, what happens is that there is, it's all my writing. But what happens is that when I decided to write, to give this project, a kind of like a skeleton that was a narrative structure, I decided that that should be a diary, and it's all my writing. But what happens is that I felt like I needed to have this text somehow come from very different places in order to point out to the complexity of like the subjective experience. At moments I am talking as a naturalist, at other moments I'm just like a journalist, and other moments I am a sloppy tourist, and other moments I am just a guy there, you know, wandering around, you know, with no clue.
At other moments you're a theorist.
That's correct.
You're writing about modernist architecture and the way in which it it blends with this sort of impersonation of animal or plant.
Exactly. So there are all those things that you know, somehow I felt like I needed to bring in, but also because I am interested in the way like the different discourses overlap to create often contradictory interpretations of things, and I'm interested in sustaining that level of contradiction and let the viewer figure things out.
Let's talk about Gold Rush.
Yes.
The Gold Rush pieces that you've made. There are three images and a video, and the video, there are two men. Can you talk about who they are and the differences, because they're starkly different?
Yes.
Sort of a delicious kind of way.
Yes. Well, the video was a poignant piece for this project, because we thought that by addressing the issues of the gold rush in this part of the world...
In Brazil.
Will also perhaps give people the chance to reflect on the history of this region of, you know, Seattle having been the last frontier in the gold rush in the United States way before. So, but this is a phenomenon that is very recent. I mean, the person that I'm interviewing is, his name is, his nickname is Cabeza, and, which means big head, and he is, you know, he's still very uncomfortable about acknowledging it. So everybody calls him head, you know. But
he built an airstrip called the airstrip of head.
Yes,
right?
that's right. And so this is what happened. The story is that I went to interview him, and he was very open because he has been interviewed by TV from everywhere before. Particularly, not recently, but before, when he was in command of the gold mining.
But you didn't know you were gonna interview him, did you?
No, not at all.
Right,
no.
You were there for something else.
I was there for something else, but then the person that I was with, who's an environmentalist and a biologist, who was taking me to all these different places where I was registering the fire. We were coming back from documenting this fire.
Okay.
And we were hungry, so we stopped to get something to eat, and he asked me if I wanted to interview, to meet this guy. I said, sure. I mean, I didn't even need to answer. He just ran and went into this place, and it was like an illegal gambling joint, and it was run by Cabeza, and he had like a tiny little room in the back that looked almost like had the austerity of a Franciscan monk. And it's so funny that this was the man who discovered gold in this region in the 70s, mid-70s, who started everything. This whole phenomenon of this city of Alta Floresta developed because of the gold rush. Mm-hmm. It's because he built the first airstrip, as you mentioned, the Pista do Cabeza, because the planes were just like landing on the clairs of forest, and it was incredibly dangerous and almost impossible to have people just showing up like that. But they were doing it. They were gold diggers. They wanted the gold. And there was nothing there, so he built one, and it became known everywhere, and it had even in maps. Basically, you were looking for gold, and you have to fly over the Amazonia jungle and find an airstrip in the middle of nowhere, and that had to be Cabeza's one, right? And people were coming from everywhere, from the States, from Europe, every country. And that, imagine this like bubble tower, but in the 70s. That's something that for us sounds like, you know, the Far West story.
Yeah, ancient sort of.
Yeah, but history. No. It's very recent history. And it was a fascinating experience to meet Cabeza and to interview him. and to learn all these things from him. Basically, one of the details that is important in the interview for me is that he points out to the fact that the Alta Floresta was colonized by families of big ranchers, of basically farmers, who had this whole sustainable project for the region, but but were very few, had very few resources. Although they were not poor, they had a very specific plan for what they were doing. But then when gold was found in the region, it was impossible to contain. I mean, there was no airport then, and they had to build seven more airstrips, you know, in the gold mining for all the planes that were coming in and out all the time. Imagine, imagine that just happening overnight. People were sleeping in hammocks, even during the rain season, which when it rains there, it rains 23 hours a day for 6 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's impossible. So these people were in like another world, mm-hmm. frankly, you know. And so he tells that story.
And he's nostalgic.
He's nostalgic about that. And he, you know, at one point, Marcus, who was the environmentalist friend of mine who took me there, asked him if he thought that the money from the gold digging was not blessed, because those who win it also lose it so easily and don't really respect it because they get it easy somehow. And Cabeza had a very different opinion on that. Mm-hmm. I said, no, that finding the gold was God's blessing. Mm-hmm. Right? So that kind of like tells us how is that we understand, you know, differently.
He wants to get back out there.
Absolutely. He's waiting for the opportunity, and he seems to have many friends who are like waiting for it too. So
it's illegal now?
It's illegal, mm-hmm. yes. But some illegal mining is happening. But you know, the environmental cost of that is very dramatic, basically mm-hmm. because they use mercury to separate the gold, mm-hmm. and that goes into the water streams, and that pollutes everything, you know, creates all kinds of birth defects in children, and you know, it's just very, very bad.
What was the place like, the gambling place in the front room?
Well, it was like being in another time, you know. It was like one of those funny looking stores that I have seen, frankly. I even have seen them in Little Italy in New York, mm-hmm. right? I used to live nearby, and I've seen them, you know, you don't know if it really is a bar or what's going on. It doesn't seem that they're selling anything. Then you go again and there's all these people gambling. They're playing cards, basically. But they were like, you know, people with guns on the table, you know, missing teeth. You know, you could see in their eyes that they were like, you know, people that have devoted their life to, you know, to chance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They believe in chance. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Then there's the other guy.
Yes.
He searched for gold 10 years and did not find it.
Exactly, Señor Enrique. And now we were visiting this other community of family farmers that were our people, our land. It's one of those like sort of like agrarian reform projects that happened in Brazil. That politicians will do that, and they will just give people some land in order to get elected, but then they will not give them the resources to develop or anything, and people wouldn't, you know, be pretty much left on their own on how to handle everything, and many of the lands were like really dreadful. They could not do anything. But this was a different case. This was a case that people had a hard time at the beginning, but then they managed to produce from these small pieces of land, and there are these farmers that have family farmers that are not, they don't have employees to cultivate the ground, but they're into sustainable farming, organic, you know, farming. Mm-hmm. And this man is not nostalgic. I mean, he basically wasted 10 years of his life looking for gold, but he stayed in the region, and now he's a farmer. And he has all kinds of wonderful things, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
pineapple.
What does
he say?
Cajun,
okra. The good kind.
Yeah, he has a good kind of okra growing there, and all kinds of other vegetables, yeah. pepper, everything, and chickens and pigs and fruits of all kinds. He produces a lot more than what. So he sells in the farmers market. The majority of it, besides, you know, sustaining himself mm-hmm. from this very small mm-hmm. piece of land, not using fertilizer, not using... So it's a very wonderful thing to see that, too, of someone who went there because of the gold, mm-hmm. right? And they're doing something entirely different.
Mm-hmm. What about the relationship between some of these works and the Northwest, especially in kind of... we haven't talked much about the architectural mm-hmm. stuff. What about that? I mean, the sort of green movement is huge here, obviously, and it has its own kind of sets of ideas and fantasies. How do you relate some of this work, especially the work that has to do with modernist architecture, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. this region?
Well, what happens is that... I don't know if I could establish any specific analogy, but what happens is that perhaps we're not so used to see the modernist aesthetic as a sign, as it happens in the Third World, particularly in parts of Latin America. But modernism there indicates a different social status. You know, if you are modern, means that you are from the upper class. Mm-hmm. And this phenomenon that I'm exploring through these Modernismo Tropical images and text here, it refers to this phenomenon of contemporary architecture that is made in the modernist style. It's like kind of like a kitsch appropriation of the modernist aesthetics that are made for noble rich people. So it's a process of gentrification of the previous areas of rainforest. This is something very, very strange, mm-hmm. right? But a lot of the people, all the flux of capital that sustains this kind of like fast enrichment for people has to do with the profiting from the other industries that are developing there, basically like the agriculture and cattle industries, which are gigantic in Mato Grosso and are really sad to see because they destroy such a wonderful rainforest areas. Even the Cerrado, which is a kind of like savanna with a whole other set of vegetations and a lot of medicinal plants that grew naturally there. Now they're being completely devastated to grow soy, to sell it to the Europeans, to feed pigs and chickens and things like that, and also to the Chinese. I mean, it's just like everywhere. Devastation is this part of the world, this paradise is part of the global economy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm exploring that process of gentrification, and perhaps people could also think about what is it that gentrification does and if it can be done in different ways, and what does it stand for?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This screen, is it intended to shield the window? Is it it's facing trees,
yes,
too.
That's true.
Why is it so large? Why is it so dark?
Well, what happens is that it is based on a specific chapter in which I enter into this dark forest, and it was... like the experience of the beginning of the Divine Comedy when Dante enters into this dark forest that he fears so much, and that the horrors that he sees there are scarier than death in itself for him, but nonetheless he's going to tell what he saw, which is the entrance into this imaginary world, and so forth. Since I had that similar experience of fear into the darkness of the jungle, I I also continue in that chapter and enter into this beautiful forest that fear, you know, is overcome by a fascination with the beauty of it. And then I end up finding the actual location of the Garden of Eden. So I wanted to show that chapter, and the aesthetics of that chapter is very much linked to the Baroque movement, and the Baroque always worked with elements of contrast, high elements of contrast. So the idea of making these photographs that I have taken of this dark forest on that occasion into a silhouette that somehow will bring the presence and at the same time the absence of the forest into an exhibition space, I thought it was ideal for the architectural conditions of this site, because it has these very large windows and like a greenhouse and so forth. That interaction between the silhouette of the rainforest and the light, somehow recreating that experience of walking in the forest. Because when you are really deep in the forest, in some areas, even if it could be noon, you know, with sunshine, and you don't see anything, you know. I mean, in most photographs that I have taken in those regions, I have to use the tripod, even in the when there is sunshine, because there is not enough light. So that was one of the things, and I thought I could make an interesting theatrical transformation of the site, of this exhibition space, by transporting another site, but also see how people think about the fact that probably there was a forest before in here, in the site where the actual exhibition space is, right? Even in Bellevue, but if it was a forest here and now it's absent, right? They have buildings.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. And I hope your own personal forest is okay.
Thank you. I hope so too.
You've been listening to Invisible with Sergio Vega. I'm Jen Graves. Thanks.
Thank you, Jen.